early 20th century, you know, the NAACP, as well as other anti-lynching activists, you know, famously argued that every 3 days, you know, an African American person is lynched. And so there's so many parallels between the anti-lynching movement of the early 20th century and the Black Lives Matter movement of the 21st century. Another connection between these two movements is, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement was started by three African American women. The anti-lynching movement, or the modern anti-lynching movement, was founded by a woman, Ida B. Wells. And so there's
famous muckraking reporter, wasn't she?
Muckraking reporter, you know, beyond sort of anti-lynching, she fought for social justice and equal opportunity. And so she's a, you know, a heroic figure.
A freedom fighter all the way. No, there's no question. Now, one of the things that might surprise, you know, and obviously I've had the chance of going through your book, is that there was a history of lynching within the African-American community as well, and it was black on black.
Absolutely. Just so that our audience kind of understands, you know, the history of lynching stretches back to the colonial era. And actually, the term lynching is actually drawn from a white colonel in the American Revolutionary Army, Colonel Charles Lynch. He was famous of, you know, punishing suspected Tories or suspected British sympathizers without a trial, without a hearing. And so hence the name lynching, for, you know, punishing someone without due process emerged. And so lynching dates back to the American Revolutionary period, and from the Revolutionary period all the way through to Reconstruction, by and large, lynching was about whites, you know, lynching other whites in general. However, by the after slavery, but particularly the late 1870s, 1880s, we find instances of African Americans lynching other African Americans. And so African Americans, in general, in the main, lynched each other because the white control legal system refused to punish crimes that black people perpetuated against other black people. And so African Americans, in certain communities, particularly in rural communities in the South, like the Mississippi Delta, the Alabama Black Belt, you had some African Americans take the law into their own hands and punish alleged or suspected criminals who perpetuated crimes against other black people. And so in the black community, lynching was a form of crime control. When we think about white-on-black lynching, that's most familiar to us. That form of lynching was typically a form of racial social control. It was a means to prevent African Americans, or actually coerce African Americans, not to agitate for their political and civil rights. And so while black people did lynch other black people, it wasn't the same, and it didn't occur for the same reasons that white on black lynching occurred.
Well, I think your argument, and it makes sense, is that we're talking about vigilantism when there is no law, and people, I mean, it's a Gunsmoke story, except in, you know, rural African American communities where there was no law and no justice and there was a perceived crime, people, whether you see it as necessary or unfortunate, were forced to take the law into their own hands. And just as the history of the West, you know, is populated with, you know, throwing a rope over a tree and cattle rustlers, this was, but it, I think you argued that it tended to be for more capital, what we would call now capital crimes. It was not a trivial matter, even in the black community.
No, it was for typically an African-American lynch victim. When they were lynched by a group of African-Americans, they were lynched because of rape and or murder. It wasn't for, I mean, if you look at the list of reasons that whites lynched black, there's over 100 reasons for why they lynched black. Some of them would be silly to us today, but in terms of black individuals lynching other blacks, it was typically for rape, for murder, for, you know, some sort of sexual crime perpetuated against a black woman or child. And so there were a very narrow group of reasons or set of reasons that motivated or precipitated black vigilantism. And so very different from white on black vigilantism.
And we don't want to overstate the case. I think one chart you had in your book, Beyond the Rope, said that the incidence was like 14% black on black as opposed to 86% from white mobs. Is that?
Yeah. So if you look at the history of black vigilantism, you know, I was only able to find about 148 cases in which an African American lynched another African American. Whereas when we look at the sweep of American history, or particularly from 1880 to 1930, roughly about 3,000 instances of white on black lynching. And so the two phenomena in terms of frequency just don't compare. And so the very relatively few amount of black vigilante incidences speak to how, you know, it really only occurred for, as you said, for capital crimes or really serious allegations.
And the tide turned around lynching as race became more of an issue. We're talking to Dr. Carlos Hill about his new book, Beyond the Rope, which unfortunately is timely. But I think that one of the points you made is that lynching became racialized, particularly in the Mississippi River Delta and similar areas later on around Reconstruction or earlier.
Lynching gets racialized, and when I say racialized, I really mean that the narrative and the justifications for lynching become about, you know, the way in which lynching gets explained and justified is through, you know, what people consider the black beast rapist or the black beast boogeyman. That's how lynching began to get justified beginning in the mid 1880s all the way through to the 1920s, so to speak. And so prior to that, again, lynching was a form of social control that stretched back to the American Revolution. By the 1880s and 1890s, it became racialized, meaning it was justified by, you know, this was something necessary to punish black people. And that occurred in part because of the changes in American society. America was becoming a rigidly segregated society with, you know, white water fountains there, black water fountains here. It became segregated, and so lynching was yet another thing that became a segregated sort of phenomenon. And so it was around that time that you saw the number of whites being lynched by whites decline, and the number of whites lynching blacks began to skyrocket. And it did so. It continued at that pace through to the first decade of the 20th century. And so, yeah, it's because of segregation that lynching becomes a racialized form of social control.
But one of the interesting things as well is that so much of this was in rural and agricultural areas, but I'm not sure the argument in your book is just because that was a lawless area, but there may have been some other factors as well.
Yeah, I mean, lynching occurred across the country. It occurred in California. It occurred in Mississippi. It occurred in Pennsylvania. It occurred in Missouri. Wherever it occurred, after 1880, it typically occurred to an African American. Although there are cases, probably the most famous case of a white person being lynched occurred in Atlanta with Leo Frank, a Jewish industrial worker who was lynched in the 19-teens. But that was sort of an exception. By and large, after the 1890s, the typical lynch victim was black. And wherever there was a black community, whether it was in the urban north or the rural south, African Americans were susceptible to lynching. And so the idea that lynching was a rural southern phenomena is kind of a myth that, and I hope my book in part explodes, although my book really does revolve around the south.
Well, and there's a famous case in New Orleans, obviously, around the Charles situation.
Yes.
You want to describe that? Because this is certainly not a small rural community here.
Yes. No, I mean, Robert Charles was an itinerant worker living in New Orleans around the turn of the century. And Robert Charles, and actually in many ways, the Robert Charles incident touches on many themes today. A police officer came across Charles sitting on a stoop in New Orleans, questioned him. The questioning turned into more of an aggressive form of questioning, it seems, and that led to Charles and the officer getting into a melee. Charles argues that the police or those who witnessed, some of those people who witnessed it, said that the police aggressively questioned and ultimately attacked Charles. Charles responded by defending himself, which led to him shooting, actually taking the weapon from the police officer, shooting the police officer, and then Charles fled the scene. And so a week's long attempt to capture and arrest him occurred. After about a week, Charles was finally identified and surrounded, and rather than surrender, Charles decides to shoot it out with the police because he believed, and he was probably right, that if he would have surrendered himself, he would have been lynched. And so Charles fights it out with the police, kills a number of police as well as whites who are trying to capture him, but ultimately they set ablaze the home that he was barricaded in, and rather than be burned alive, Charles one last attempt to kill some of the people who were there to lynch him. He runs out and he's killed in a blaze of fire or in a blaze of bullets. And then he's subsequently lynched. You know, his body's dragged through the streets of New Orleans. His body is hung in a prominent place in downtown New Orleans for all to see. And so Charles is, like many other African Americans before him and definitely after him, faced a really brutal death.
Well, and Ida Wells, in writing about this, changed the narrative a little bit on these lynchings. I think that's one of the more interesting arguments you make, and argued that some of what Charles' reaction was resistance, and there was even a level of heroism involved. Is that?
Yes, I mean, Ida B. Wells was an anti-lynching crusader, but as you mentioned, she was a muckraker. And so Ida B. Wells, lived in an era in which black lynch victims were seen as black beast rapists. Mm-hmm. She lived in an era where African Americans weren't seen as victims. They were black beast rapists. And so she tried to tell a different story through the life and the lynching of Robert Charles. Instead of focusing on him as a black beast rapist, she argued that he was a hero, which was heresy at the time, right? Particularly for a white community who felt justified in lynching Charles. And so she argues through his courageous, manly self-defense and standing up for himself in terms of his civil and political rights, he deserves to be remembered as the hero of New Orleans. And by saying that, she was in many ways, trying to make a case that, Andrew Jackson, who was seen as the hero of New Orleans because of his heroic defeat of the British Navy in 1812, saving New Orleans, she was trying to push him over and say, we should really remember Robert Charles for his self-defense as the hero of New Orleans. And so she, in that way, was trying to carve out a new way of understanding black lynch victims, not as black beast rapists, but as heroic figures. And I think, or at least what I argue in the book, is that this became a way that other African-American writers, other African-American activists began to conceptualize African-American lynch victims. And so, I talk at length about this in the book.
Yeah, there's no question. And, I know you also touched a little on the Elaine massacre, which is obviously one of the low points of Arkansas history where we're broadcast here. How does that impact on this whole theme?
Yes, I mean, you know, the Elaine massacre, where some say as many as 800 African Americans were killed, brutally killed, is definitely a low point, if not the lowest point in African American history. You know, and it has been seen in that way. And so I tell a story in the book about a woman whose father narrowly escaped a lynching. And, you know, she, rather than remember all the brutality, all the death, she really focuses her story about Elaine on her father's clandestine escape from a lynch mob and how he, in order to escape with his life, he fought back valiantly. And so,
once again, the hero theme in some ways.
Yeah, basically, you know, an example of heroic manhood. And so, again, lynch victims, particularly black male lynch victims, have been seen as black beast rapists, or, you know, they have been seen as helpless victims. And so, by her focusing on her father's heroism, she acknowledges the brutality of the massacre, but she highlights and puts a highlight on his heroism in order to tell a story of lynching that was empowering, a story of lynching that could actually be useful and usable for African Americans going forward. And so this is what I throughout the book try to highlight, that African Americans have not always, thought about black lynch victims as victims. Sometimes they thought about them as heroic figures. Sometimes they thought about them as martyrs. But it's never necessarily been just simply victims. And so that's an important point, because I think we live in an era in which our standard default position is to think about African Americans as victims of racial violence. And while that's an important narrative, that's an important way to think about it, in some cases, it's not always the desirable way to think about African Americans and racial violence. And so this book tries to show this much longer history of how African Americans have related to lynch victims in various ways and for various reasons.
Well, we can't escape the theme of resistance. We're talking to Dr. Carlos Hill, the University of Oklahoma, who's written a book, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. And since we're talking about resistance, it's hard not to bring this to the current times and how this history has an unfortunate legacy still in police community relationships. And I know I've read that you felt that we were making some progress, and after Dallas, you're not so sure. Give me some of your thoughts on how this history influences and instructs our contemporary situation.
Well, I mean, part of my argument in the book is that the lynched black body as a kind of symbol is a floating signifier. So throughout African American history, African Americans, so at one point African Americans, particularly when we talk about the history of black vigilantism, saw lynchings as warranted. However, when lynching became racialized, they became the primary targets of lynching. African Americans pivoted to trying to conceive of black lynch victims as sort of helpless victims, hapless victims of white lynch mob violence. However, in order to sort of overcome the trauma of lynching psychologically, culturally, African Americans tried to tell news stories, consoling narratives where they saw black lynch victims as more empowering and heroic and resisting. We live in an era now, the Black Lives Matter movement, where African Americans, according to Black Lives Matter, are shot and killed by police. Unarmed black people are shot and killed by police every 28 hours. And so this has precipitated a victimization narrative of African Americans. And so today, many people call these police shootings of African Americans as 21st century lynchings. Now, you know, I've argued in several places that these are not lynchings. However, you know, these police shootings are not lynchings. However, there's some deep resonances between them. And so one of probably the deepest resonance between them is the sense of terror that African American people feel when they come in contact with police. They feel as if they are under attack, that they can be shot and killed for any reason at all. And probably the perfect example of that is Philando Castile, who's, you know, doing everything that the police officer asked him to do, but nonetheless, he's shot and killed, he loses his life. And so there's a sense of terror and terrorism that black people are feeling, just in the same way that lynching, white-on-black lynching, was meant to inspire terror. If we take it a little bit further and talk about a culture of impunity that seems to shroud police officers, it almost seems as if police officers can do no wrong when it comes to African Americans. So if we take a look at Baltimore and the five officers who were responsible or seemingly responsible for Freddie Gray's death, all of them go free. None of them actually are punished for causing his death. This goes back to the era of lynching when police officers, when they aided and abetted or were simply indifferent to white lynch mobs lynching blacks, nothing ever happened to those police officers. And so there seems to be a culture of impunity that existed in the era of lynching that exists today. And so this is why people are calling these police shootings 21st century lynchings. Not that they are one and the same, but there's some associations that we can't ignore. And so, again, I don't think that these are lynchings, but there are some resonances between these two phenomena.
And, of course, the statistics are that 25% of those killed by police, African-Americans, are unarmed.
Yes.
So that's, no matter how we, you know, shake and bake this thing, you can't get around that figure. How can 25% unarmed people be killed in the course of, you know, daily life in largely our cities? But Dallas, you felt, as I gathered, that we were making some progress on, we had some hope around this for change around community police relationships, but you were afraid that Dallas changed that.
Yeah, for about 36 hours after Philando Castile was killed, shot and killed by police, as well, Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge,
right.
When those videotapes surfaced. For about 36 hours, you had Republicans, conservatives coming out saying that those shootings were unwarranted,
mm-hmm.
those shootings were despicable, and it seemed as if they were beginning to get it. They were beginning to say, you know what, there needs to be some police reform in America. This is getting out of hand. And then Dallas occurred, and it completely changed the narrative. It completely undermined, undercut the growing momentum, right, in quarters that had been resistant to the idea that police reform was necessary. And so it changed the narrative to, we need to rally behind our police. We need to support the blue. And all the attacks on Black Lives Matter that had seemingly been tamped down by these two, in terms of those two shootings, came back with a vengeance. And so it just sort of undercut a moment that that had been building definitely for the last 2 years. And so it allowed for the more reactionary forces to double down on Blue Lives Matter versus be more sympathetic to Black Lives Matter. So what we saw at the Republican convention was really a doubling down, maybe even a tripling down, on the notion that Blue Lives Matter, because you didn't hear one word about police reform there. You didn't hear one word about, or one positive word about, the Black Lives Matter movement. All we really got is, you know, law and order. And when you hear law and order, historically that's been a word used to, as a word to sort of, a code word for let's repress black activists groups, particularly black radical activist groups. And so I was very worried when I watched the Republican convention, because it seemed as if and within those quarters, it seemed that people were beginning to say, you know what, maybe let's take a second look at this. But now I think it's you know,
we've lost that moment for a second. But you're a braver man than I that you watched any of the Republican convention. I mean, I read about it closely in the papers, but I just couldn't go there. And it's a tragic irony because the police chief in Baton Rouge has been as bad as the police chief in Dallas has at least been presented as trying to be more positive coming out of this experience. So there clearly are voices even on the police that understand and change in the New York police commissioner situation that understand there's got to be change, but the political climate is not encouraging right now, given the polarization. Dr. Hill, this is an interesting book. How, beyond the rope, the impact of lynching in black culture and memory, how can people get a hold of a copy of this?
The easiest way is to order it on Amazon.com. But you can also order it if you don't like to patronize Amazon. You can also buy it directly from the Cambridge University website. Those are the two primary places that you can, I think you can access the book.
Amazon, unfortunately, owns the world now, and a drone may deliver this book to you soon. And I know your new position in Oklahoma, are you connected to an institute there that's looking at racial issues?
You know, I just arrived a week ago, so I'm not really connected to anyone at this point.
Yeah, you're not even connected to utilities, hardly. I gotcha.
Yeah.
But is there a way that if people want to get in touch with you and find out more about your thinking? I know you're writing another book. You're working on another book as well that involves a lynching victim or worse. Is there a way people can get a hold of you?
Yeah, there's two ways. If you want to hear conversations about race and culture on a weekly basis, I co-host a podcast called Tapestry, a conversation on race and culture. That's probably the easiest way to keep in contact with me on a weekly basis, particularly during the fall and the spring. And so if you follow that show, you can definitely get in contact with me, as well as you can email me, or actually better yet, you could connect with me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @thinkingforachange, without an E. And so those are the two primary ways that I would say if people want to continue this conversation about the history of lynching, race and culture, those are two ways to connect with me.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams usually sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. We say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we're going to learn about mental health, consumers organizing in Alaska, of all places. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you. See you next Friday.